Chapter 7 had resolved itself on this occasion into something very like great and late. He remembered that there had just been a political crisis, which accounted for the enlargement of the Countess of Chenelcliffe's assembly, for hers was one of the neutral, or non-political houses at which party politics are more freely agitated than at the professedly party gatherings. There was such a string of carriages that Pearson did not wait to take his turn at the door, but unobtrusively alighted some yards off and walked forward. He had to pause a moment behind the wall of spectators which barred his way, and as he paused some ladies in white cloaks crossed from their carriages to the door on the carpet laid for the purpose. He had not seen their faces, nothing of them but vague forms, and yet he was suddenly seized with a presentiment. Its gist was that he might be going to re-encounter the well-beloved that night. After her recent long hiding she meant to reappear, and intoxicate him. That liquid sparkle of her eye, that lingual music, that turn of the head, how well he knew it all, despite the many superficial changes, and how instantly he would recognize it under whatever complexion, contour, accent, height, or carriage that it might choose to masquerade. Pearson's other conjecture, that the night was to be a lively political one, received confirmation as soon as he reached the hall, where a simmer of excitement was perceptible as surplus or overflow from above down the staircase, a feature which he had always noticed to be present, when any climax or sensation had been reached in the world of party and faction. "And where have you been keeping yourself so long, young man?" said his hostess archly, when he had shaken hands with her. Pearson was always regarded as a young man, though he was now about 40.
"Oh yes, of course, I remember," she added, looking serious in a moment at thought of his loss. The Countess was a woman with a good-natured manner verging on that oft-claimed feminine quality, humor, and was quickly sympathetic. She then began to tell him of a scandal in the political side to which she nominally belonged, one that had come out of the present crisis, and that, as for herself, as he had sworn to abjure politics forever on account of it, so that he was to regard her forthwith as a more neutral householder than ever. By this time some more people had surged upstairs, and Pearson prepared to move on. "You are looking for somebody, I can see that," said she.
"Yes, a lady," said Pearson.
"Tell me her name, and I'll try to think if she's here."
"I cannot, I don't know it," he said.
"Indeed. What is she like?"
"I cannot describe her, not even her complexion or dress."
Lady Chenelcliffe looked a pout, as if she thought he were teasing her, and he moved on in the current. The fact was that, for a moment, Pearson fancied he had made the sensational discovery that the one he was in search of lurked in the person of the very hostess he had conversed with, who was charming always, and particularly charming tonight. He was just feeling an incipient consternation at the possibility of such a jade's trick in his beloved, who had once before chosen to embody herself as a married woman, though, happily, at that time with no serious results. However, he felt that he had been mistaken, and that the fancy had been solely owing to the highly charged electric condition in which he had arrived by reason of his recent isolation. The whole set of rooms formed one great utterance of the opinions of the hour. The gods of party were present with their embattled seraphim, but the brilliance of manner and form in the handling of public questions was only less conspicuous than the paucity of original ideas. No principles of wise government had place in any mind, a blunt and jolly personalism, as to the ins and outs animating all. But Jocelyn's interest did not run in this stream. He was like a stone in a purling brook, waiting for some peculiar floating object to be brought towards him, and to stick upon his mental surface. Thus looking for the next new version of the fair figure, he did not consider at the moment, though he had done so at other times, that this presentiment of meeting her was, of all presentiments, just the sort of one to work out its own fulfillment. He looked for her in the knot of persons gathered round a past prime minister who was standing in the middle of the largest room discoursing in the genial, almost jovial, manner natural to him at these times. The two or three ladies forming his audience had been joined by another in black and white, and it was on her that Pearson's attention was directed, as well as the great statesman's, whose first sheer gaze at her, expressing "Who are you?" almost audibly, changed into an interested, listening look as the few words she spoke were uttered, for the minister differed from many of his standing in being extremely careful not to interrupt a timid speaker, giving way in an instant if anybody else began with him. Nobody knew better than himself that all may learn, and his manner was that of an unconceited man who could catch an idea readily, even if he could not undertake to create one. The lady told her little story, whatever it was. Jocelyn could not hear it. The statesman laughed. "Ha ha ha!" The lady blushed. Jocelyn, brought up to a high tension by the aforesaid presentiment, that is Shelley in one shape of many names, was about to reappear, paid little heed to the others, watching for a full view of the lady who had won his attention. That lady remained for the present partially screened by her neighbors. A diversion was caused by Lady Chanelcliffe bringing up somebody to present to the ex-minister. The ladies got mixed, and Jocelyn lost sight of the one whom he was beginning to suspect as the stealthily returned absentee. He looked for her in a kindly young lady of the house, his hostess's relation, who appeared to more advantage that night than as he had ever done before in a sky-blue dress, which had nothing between it, and the fair skin of her neck, lending her an unusually soft and sylph-like aspect. She saw him, and they converged. Her look of "What do you think of me now?" was suggested, he knew, by the thought that the last time they met as he had appeared under the disadvantage of morning clothes, on a wet day in a country house, where everybody was cross. "I have some new photographs, and I want you to tell me whether they are good," she said. "Mind you are to tell me truly, and no favor." She produced the pictures from an adjoining drawer, and they sat down together upon an ottoman for the purpose of examination. The portraits, taken by the last fashionable photographer, were very good, and he told her so, but as he spoke and compared them his mind was fixed on something else than the mere judgment. He wondered whether the elusive one were indeed in the frame of this girl. He looked up at her. To his surprise, her mind, too, was on other things bent than on the pictures. Her eyes were glancing away to distant people. She was apparently considering the effect she was producing upon them by this cozy tete-a-tete with Pearson, and upon one in particular, a man of 30, of military appearance, whom Pearson did not know. Quite convinced now that no phantom belonging to him was contained in the outlines of the present young lady, he could coolly survey her as he responded. They were both doing the same thing. Each was pretending to be deeply interested in what the other was talking about, the attention of the two alike flitting away to other corners of the room, even when the very point of their discourse was pending. No, he had not seen her yet. He was not going to see her, apparently, tonight. She was scared away by the twanging political atmosphere. But he still moved on searchingly, hardly heeding certain spectral imps other than Aphroditean, who always haunted these places, and jeeringly pointed out that under the white hair of this or that ribanded old man, with a forehead grown wrinkled over treaties which had swayed the fortunes of Europe, with a voice which had numbered sovereigns among its respectful listeners, might be a heart that would go inside a nutshell, that beneath this or that white rope of pearl and pink bosom, might lie the half lung which had, by hook or by crook, to sustain its possessor above ground till the wedding day. At that moment he encountered his amiable host, and almost simultaneously caught sight of the lady who had at first attracted him, and then had disappeared. Their eyes met, far off as they were from each other. Pearson laughed inwardly. It was only in ticklish excitement as to whether this was to prove a true travail, and with no instinct to mirth. For when under the eyes of his Jill o' the Wisp he was more inclined to palpitate like a sheep in a fair. However, for the minute he had to converse with his host, Lord Shenelcliffe, and almost the first thing that friend said to him was, "Who is that pretty woman in the black dress with the white fluff about it, and the pearl necklace?" "Apostrophe, apostrophe, I don't know, apostrophe," said Jocelyn, with incipient jealousy. "I was just going to ask the same thing. Apostrophe, apostrophe, oh, we shall find out presently, I suppose. I dare say my wife knows." Apostrophe, they had parted, when a hand came upon his shoulder. Lord Shenelcliffe had turned back for an instant. "I find she is the granddaughter of my father's old friend, the last Lord Hengistbury. Her name is Mrs. Pinavon. She lost her husband 2 or 3 years ago, very shortly after their marriage." Apostrophe, apostrophe, Lord Shenelcliffe became absorbed into some adjoining dignitary of the church, and Pearson was left to pursue his quest alone. A young friend of his, the Lady Mabella Buttermead, who appeared in a cloud of muslin and was going on to a ball, had been brought against him by the tide. A warm-hearted, emotional girl was Lady Mabella, who laughed at the humorousness of being alive. She asked him whither he was bent, and he told her, "Oh yes, I know her very well." "Apostrophe, apostrophe," said Lady Mabella eagerly. "She told me one day that she particularly wished to meet you. Poor thing, so sad she lost her husband." "Well, it was a long time ago now, certainly. Women ought not to marry and lay themselves open to such catastrophes, ought they, Mr. Pearson?" "I never shall. I am determined never to run such a risk. Now, do you think I shall? Apostrophe, marry?" "Oh no, never," apostrophe said Pearson dryly. "That's very satisfying." Apostrophe, apostrophe, but Mabella was scarcely comfortable under his answer, even though jestingly returned, and she added, "But sometimes I think I may, just for the fun of it. Now we'll steer across to her, and catch her, and I'll introduce you. But we shall never get to her at this rate. Apostrophe, apostrophe, never, unless we adopt the ugly rush, like the citizens who follow the Lord Mayor's show." Apostrophe, apostrophe, they talked, and inched towards the desired one, who, as she discoursed with a neighbor, seemed to be of those female forms whose gestures beam with mind, apostrophe, seen by the poet in his vision of the golden city of Islam. Their progress was continually checked. Pearson was, as he had sometimes seemed to be in a dream, unable to advance towards the object of pursuit, unless he could have gathered up his feet into the air. After 10 minutes given to a preoccupied regard of shoulder blades, back hair, glittering headgear, neck napes, moles, hairpins, pearl powder, pimples, minerals cut into facets of many colored rays, necklace clasps, fans, stays, the 7 styles of elbow and arm, the 13 varieties of ear, and by using the toes of his dress boots as coulters with which he plowed his way, and that of Lady Mabella in the direction they were aiming at, he drew near to Mrs. Pinavon, who was drinking a cup of tea in the back drawing room. "My dear Nicola, we thought we should never get to you, because it is worse tonight, owing to these dreadful politics. But we've done it." Apostrophe, and she proceeded to tell her friend of Pearson's existence hard by. It seemed that the widow really did wish to know him, and that Lady Mabella Buttermead had not indulged in one of the 2 frequent inventions in that kind. When the youngest of the trio had made the pair acquainted with each other, she left them to talk to a younger man than the sculptor. Mrs. Pinavon's black velvets and silks, with their white accompaniments, finely set off the exceeding fairness of her neck and shoulders, which, though unwhitened artificially, were without a speck or blemish of the least degree. The gentle, thoughtful creature she had looked from a distance she now proved herself to be, she held also sound, rather than current opinions on the plastic arts, and was the first intellectual woman he had seen there that night, except 1 or 2 as aforesaid. They soon became well acquainted, and at a pause in their conversation noticed the fresh excitement caused by the arrival of some latecomers with more news. The latter had been brought by a rippling, bright-eyed lady in black, who made the men listen to her, whether they would or no. "I am glad I am an outsider," apostrophe said Jocelyn's acquaintance, now seated on a sofa beside which he was standing. "I wouldn't be like my cousin, over there, for the world. She thinks her husband will be turned out at the next election, and she's quite wild." "Yes. It is mostly the women who are the gamesters. The men only the cards. The pity is that politics are looked on as being a game for politicians, just as cricket is a game for cricketers, not as the serious duties of political trustees. How few of us ever think, or feel that the nation of every country dwells in the cottage, as somebody says. Yes. Though I wonder to hear you quote that. I am of no party, though my relations are. There can be only one best course at all times, and the wisdom of the nation should be directed to finding it, instead of zigzagging in two courses, according to the will of the party which happens to have the upper hand. Having started thus, they found no difficulty in agreeing on many points. When Pearson went downstairs from that assembly at 1:45, and passed under the steaming nostrils of an ambassador's horses to a hansom which waited for him against the railing of the square, he had an impression that the beloved had re-emerged from the shadows, without any hint or initiative from him to whom, indeed, such re-emergence was an unquestionably awkward thing. In this he was aware, however, that though it might be now, as heretofore, the loved who danced before him, it was the goddess behind her who pulled the string of that jumping jill. He had lately been trying his artist hand again on the D's form in every conceivable phase and mood. He had become a one-part man, a presenter of her only. But his efforts had resulted in failures. In her implacable vanity she might be punishing him anew for presenting her so deplorably. 2. She draws close and satisfies. He could not forget Mrs. Pinavon's eyes, though he remembered nothing of her other facial details. They were round, inquiring, luminous. How that chestnut hair of hers had shone. It required no tiara to set it off, like that of the dowager he had seen there, who had put £10,000 upon her head, to make herself look worse than she would have appeared with an anemone muslin cap of a servant woman. Now the question was, ought he to see her again? He had his doubts. But, unfortunately for discretion, just when he was coming out of the rooms he had encountered an old lady of 70, his friend Mrs. Brightwalton, the Honorable Mrs. Brightwalton, and as he had hastily asked him to dinner for the day after the morrow, stating in the honest way he knew so well that as he had heard he was out of town, or she would. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.